SafetyFM.com with Jay Allen. Changing safety cultures, one broadcast and one podcast at a time.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Safety FM with Jay Allen. I hope everything is good and grand inside of your neck of the woods as we are coming to you on this lovely April the 16th, which is a Tuesday and also known as the day after tax day for 2024. So hopefully you got all those taxes filed away if you're here in the U.S. If not, well, hopefully you had enough time to file an extension, but we'll leave that here nor there in regards of what's going on. Anyways, we are coming to you from downtown Chicago because that's what we have going on this week. So that's where we're at. So if you kind of hear a little bit different sound, that's the reason. But don't worry, we're going to go back into the past and then kind of bring you into the future all at the same time. Gets a little confusing when somebody starts talking that way, but it'll make sense here in just a little bit. So today's plan is we're going to go back to one of the presentations that was done at the Global Innovation Safety Summit. Matter of fact, the Global Safety Innovation Summit, that's the proper way of saying that, that occurred in Wollongong back in Australia back in the month of February. I can't believe that we're in April. It almost already seems like an eternity since I was actually down in Australia. But today we're going to sit back and we're going to take a listen to a presentation by Ben Hutchinson. He is a rail safety leader. Also, he is a PhD candidate and had a great presentation that was done while in Wollongong. What I would love for you to do is sit back, relax today, and take a listen to Ben Hutchinson as he speaks at what exactly was going down in Wollongong during his presentation. Take a listen to it here today on Safety FM with Jay Allen. Sit back, relax, here we go.
So today I'm going to be talking about the way that our systems in organisations, it's not just safety systems, it's not just safety management systems, it's really all the social systems we have in place too. Sometimes they can actually work against us and increase our risk, exposure to risk, rather than helping us to manage and navigate the uncertainties of risk. I'll be picking on audits in particular, but it doesn't just apply to audits. And you know what? What's really interesting, actually, is HOP isn't immune to these sorts of, like the philosophies of HOP aren't immune to these sorts of socio-technical factors that can increase our risk. For other reasons that I won't explain, I think sort of the HOP philosophies probably are better calibrated to navigating these sorts of issues. But just keep that in mind, that it sort of applies across the board. And I'll be presenting a couple of papers that I've published with the co-authors around audits and how they contribute to this false sense of safety. So I want to start with a couple of stories. I think stories usually start pretty good when they're accidents. Unfortunately, there's a written blood. But I think there's some things that we can extract from them. And these two in particular, so Piper Alpha was mentioned, I think, by Dave the other day. And we have SO Longford, a gas plant in Victoria, down the bottom. What I found striking about these two events, but there's so many of these, unfortunately, there's so many, is that prior to the disasters occurring, there was glowing reports around the functionality of the safety systems. So audits were praising the performance. You can see down the bottom that the ESO's operating management system was based on the best practice, international knowledge. It was well understood, it was well known, it was well functioning. We're going to come back to those two examples a little bit later on. Something that I think is critical, it's one factor amongst many, but I think it's really critical to understand how this sort of false sense of safety can develop, is that we don't actually create patterns of action. We don't create routines. What we create are artifacts. Now, artifacts could they're written things. They could be art. They could be clothing. Artifacts are products of humans. In the safety world, we love written artifacts. What we actually intend to do is, if you take confined spaces, for instance, we might tweak the standard. We might tweak a confined space permit. What we actually intended, though, was to change the work that people do, the routines of confined space entry and confined space work. What we end up creating is an artifact of it, an abstract representation of that work. And this one helps to explain why we can become decoupled or disconnected from the things that we're trying to manage. It's because we come to take the artifact as the work itself. It's really easy to sort of conflate the two, but they're not the same thing. We can tweak a whole lot of artifacts, a whole lot of documents, and still not really directly change the work that people do out in the field. So I think it's important to realise that, yeah, we create artifacts rather than the routines. And as we know, the routines in practice, the things that people actually do, often do differ from what the designers of the artifact intended. And this could be us. This could be workers themselves that create artifacts and representations of their work that's still different to how they intended to perform the work. So improvisation and variability is inherent in almost everything that we do, for better or worse. I think a useful example came out of the San Bruno pipeline explosion. So Jan Hayes and Andrew Hopkins discussed this in some papers and a book. There was the pipeline was installed in 1956 with a poor quality weld. I don't have the time to go through it all, but essentially what they did is they had their own risk algorithms and risk scores that helped prioritise which segments of the pipeline would be inspected, how they inspect it, when, where, and they would need to because you're talking about hundreds or thousands of kilometres of pipeline, buried pipeline. What was really fascinating about this example was their risk exposure scores, the ways that they prioritised the risk exposure was said to be completely divorced from the actual level of risk as it existed in the field. So the integrity of the pipeline and the scores that they calculated weren't correlated. So essentially what Jan said was they were divorced from reality. They were symbolic more than anything. Now, people were doing what they were supposed to do. They were following the process. They were completing the forms. Unfortunately, what they were doing was managing the system and its artifacts rather than managing operational integrity of a pipeline. But they thought it was the same thing. And why wouldn't they believe that? They had the data to convince them. They were following the rules. They were doing what they were supposed to do. But unfortunately, in hindsight, of course, they were really misguided in their focus. So what we argue is that these artifacts can normalise danger by allowing us to believe that we've got the issues under control. But sometimes we may not. So let's go back to the two examples I started with. I was really struck by this paradox between how can an audit or any sort of feedback on one hand come back with glowing feedback and then suddenly after something blows up, the systems were suddenly not functioning. Lots of explanations, lots of narratives we can build around it. But we wanted to study that in the context of audits. What role do audits play in desensitising us to operational work, operational risk? Or maybe are they? Perhaps they are really well calibrated. I didn't really understand what the correlation was. So we started with our first paper, which looked at 71 audit reports in a large tier one construction company in Australia. Now, the data was from one company, but it included 16 independent professional auditing bodies that were auditing that company on behalf of the client. I don't have the time to go through all the key findings, but essentially there's about 327 findings that we coded from the audits. We're interested in what do auditors look at? What do they talk about? And of course, the limitation is this wasn't auditing work. It was a product of auditing work. But it still came up with some really fascinating findings around sort of what auditors are looking at. What do they accept as evidence? How does that correlate to the things that they're trying to manage? What we kind of concluded from this was that in some instances, it appeared that auditing seemed to be a really sophisticated way to avoid really uncomfortable findings. The second one was, and Dave mentioned this the other day around counterfactual reasoning. So this study wanted to look at what do accident investigators think about auditing. Of course, it's really easy when the smoke is clear to be able to come up with all the breadcrumbs around what failed, what worked. So we do have to consider what they call delusional clarity. It's the clarity that you get in hindsight. But as I will say, it's really hard to find a royal inquiry when something doesn't blow up. So by necessity, we kind of do move towards major accidents. But essentially, we coded, there was 44 accident reports out of thousands that we evaluated. That's how few actually talk about the role of audits. Maybe the audits weren't relevant, but we're almost in the dark because they just don't generally talk about auditing. what I'll do is I'll go through some of the key insights that came out of these two studies and how they sort of applied to safety more generally. So one of the key themes, and this one was across both studies, it's not even just auditing, this one's everywhere, is this idea of service compliance. Some other researchers coined this term. Essentially, it's a type of work that we do where it's really just merely demonstrating adherence or compliance to something at a very surface level. It's not poor work. It's not bad apples. It's not people doing the wrong thing. We convince ourselves, or we have trade-offs and sacrifices and decisions to make. We need to get the work done. So we fill the form in, and we don't really achieve what the overarching goal of the form was or the process. We believe that we found two examples of this in particular in audits, the surface compliance. So an illusion of depth and the conflation of the artifacts with the issues. So for instance, we found examples like there was an excavator quick hitch pin that was missing and there was a cable tie that was used instead. And the auditor found that, which I thought was quite an interesting observation. But the audit then asked for the immediate rectification of that issue. What I thought was striking about that was we found almost no examples where the audit would direct the organisation to understand why a cable tie was used in the first place. How did this checks and balances in the organisation not pick up on this sort of thing? Why would someone need to use a cable tie instead? There's going to be some logics around it. It would have made sense for someone to do that. The audits were largely silent on these sort of questions. So they were militantly focused on fixing immediate conditions and properties of the organisation. So what we argued is we didn't find actually any examples of audits that called for the rectification of a family of issues, as we called it quite clumsily. So what we're saying is if that's something that's safety critical, and they did occasionally find, not too often, they did occasionally find stuff that wasn't, I guess we'd call it bullshit. Most of the time it was BS, but they did occasionally find stuff that was critical. But in every instance, it was always the immediate rectification of that issue. It was never, where else does it exist? Is this an issue across the business? Is there something we can learn to improve on it? Also, what we've found across the two studies was audits that sort of treated the issues as the same as the artifact itself. So I think a really telling example was one of the audit questions was, has the facility identified all of the major hazards? And the evidence that was presented was, yes, there's a recently reviewed, completed site risk register. But when you think about it, it's not the same thing. You can have a completed site risk register, but that still doesn't answer the question of whether you've identified the relevant major hazards on the facility. We found lots of examples of that. It was across permits also. There was also an example where the audit was asking for, I can't remember what process it was, but is there a process that exists for this activity? Is it understood? Is it effective? And the evidence was, yes, there was a process flowchart observed on a notice board. I thought, again, it's not evidence that the process is understood. It exists in reality. It's actual routine that people would perform. And we don't know if it actually works. Having a flowchart on a notice board doesn't actually indicate that the process itself is functional. The general assumption, of course, is that changing an artifact somehow connects with the work. I think it's a fair assumption to have for us to work like that, but we really need to validate whether that's the reality. Another one was this lack of connection between requirements and specifications. So just really quickly, a requirement can be seen as the overarching goal of something, and the specifications are all the individual ways we achieve that requirement. So if we take a mine ventilation plan, or if we take an emergency management plan, the requirements of emergency management plan is to manage emergencies. The specifications are all the individual ways that we try and achieve that goal. What we found with audits and everywhere else, this isn't just for audits, but there's a whole lot of stuff. I think Dave and Drew put this nicely with, there's a lot of safety work involved with specifications that don't necessarily help us get better at the requirements. So at Pike River, the New Zealand mining disaster, they had a ventilation management plan. So I got the risk assessments for Freedom of Information Act. sort of evaluated what was the risk assessment telling us, or telling the people who was completing it. And in the ventilation management plan, it seemed really thorough. It all seemed sciencey. It seemed like it was based on the best sort of knowledge around mining ventilation. And people would have believed that to be the case. What I found really fascinating about the risk assessment was it had a whole bunch of reds on it. And the goal generally, this was described in the Royal Commission, was to get the reds into the green. Now, it wasn't supposed to be like a tick and flick, that people would generally believe that they were doing the right thing. But what was really telling, I think, was the reds were downgraded to greens, okay? But those controls, or some of those controls, just didn't exist in reality. It was a fantasy document. It made people feel really comfortable. It allayed our subjective concerns. We felt like we completed the issue. Like, it allowed work to progress, but it just didn't reflect reality. The controls, some of them just didn't exist either at all, or they didn't exist the way that artifact assumed that they would. We found the same with audits. Audits seemed to focus a lot on all this minor stuff. Signatures, templates, version numbers, spelling. We found examples of them pointing out spelling at a hazardous facility. I don't know if we have any, I probably should have checked. I don't know if we have any auditors here. Hey, I love you guys. But I don't know what it is about first aid kits and fire extinguishers. It's like the birthday every day for auditors. They love them. They absolutely love them. So even when auditors did get out in the field, and look, I know you'll say they're limited by time. We're exploring that factor right now with an interview study with auditors. But even when they go out into the field, they understand the operational work. It's almost always on surface level stuff. Signage, without really understanding what the purpose of the signage is, it's never discussed. I think I'm digressing. One example that I really liked actually was, I'm running short on time, was a site inspection schedule was identified. So essentially the site wasn't completing the site inspections that they said they were going to complete. And I thought this was really interesting was the recommendation from the audit was to update the site site inspection schedule. I was thinking, the fix for a process that isn't getting used is to update the process that isn't getting used. I was like, what the? So it's focusing on the artifact in the assumption that that's focusing on the lack of inspections, but it's not the same thing. I think there's two left. Another one was this symbolic safety. It is important. Symbolism is a very important thing. I was actually just reflecting on rituals. A lot of this is involved around rituals. And even just the ritual of presenters usually standing off to the side of the stage waiting to be presented, and then they walk up on stage. That's a ritual. A lot of the safety activities we do are a form of ritual. And a ritual means something that we usually do fairly often or repeated, but we don't necessarily think about why we're doing it. Signatures are very symbolic and ritualistic. So what we found was signatures being conflated with the understanding or knowledge of a process. So for instance, we found examples of SWIMs or risk assessments that were signed, and that was essentially synonymously associated with the worker's comprehension of that process. So what I mean is, by virtue of signing something, you're accepting or validating that you've understood it. But again, it's not the same thing. Someone signing something doesn't mean they've actually A, read it, or if they've read it, doesn't mean they've comprehended it. But so often, signatures had this really perverse, powerful symbolic effect, or at least appeared to. It certainly has based on interviews with auditors also. So Michael Power, he's one of the most prolific researchers around auditing. He called this rituals of verification. We do them because we think it's the right thing to be doing, but it's not necessarily telling us what we think they're telling us. They're very much, I think I would call them quite rightly, fantasy documents. And this is the last one, one of the key insights that I think came out of it. So a lot of audits underestimated or misrepresented certain hazards, like in the process industries, like combustible dust was seen as food safety issues and things like that. A lot of little examples like that, you'd probably expect that to a degree. What I thought was really fascinating was this idea we coined called failing silent. So we have a process and we expect if it doesn't work, we'll get some sort of intel that it's not working. We talk about amplifying weak signals or being early warning signs of impending disaster. So we wanted to explore, do audits function as amplifiers of weak signals? What was really fascinating was we found a lot of examples where audits don't seem to, A, identify the issues in advance, and B, and I think more importantly, is they don't provide any really tangible, obvious feedback that they're not functioning as expected. So what I mean is if you ask a sample of leaders what they think an audit's doing, I think some will say, checking compliance, but it's checking the effectiveness of systems. They're certainly checking that things are there. They're not really checking that the things actually work as intended. So we called it failing silent. And what is even more, I think, perverse and dangerous about this failing silent is some processes don't just fail silent in the fact that they don't give you any feedback. We saw examples where the audits actually give you unwarranted praise about how well the system's functioning, even though it's not in some very critical ways. It was also observed at Piper Alpha with the permit to work system. The absence of bad news by default indicated that nothing was wrong. But it just wasn't providing the feedback that they thought that they would have needed for managing critical work. I think about 50 seconds. I hope that was interesting. There's a lot more. I had to skip out a lot of the findings. But these things are found everywhere. What I really want to get people to think about is the ritualistic nature of what we do, the symbolism about doing using a form, performing a practice. Again, artifacts and these activities aren't just physical things. They're informal, discussions, engagements. They apply equally to a learning team or a one-on-one engagement with someone as they do to a written permit. Have a little bit of time, I think, if we got questions.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Really, really good talks generate really good questions. So there's a couple here, a cluster. What are your recommendations for conducting better audits, integrating HOC principles, and something related, a question regarding better questions?
So I was preempting that I'd get the question around, if audits suck, what should we be doing? The cop-out answer is, I don't know. And even if I did, I don't think it'd be really valuable to give you a cookie-cutter response. What I will say and what we argued in one of the papers was you need to be really clear about what you think the audit is doing and what it's supposed to achieve. I think that's probably one of the most important takeaways for me, at least professionally, is if we think the audit is primarily just checking documents, it's doing it surface level, desktop review to check that an emergency plan has been reviewed, I don't actually think that's problematic. It's doing what we expect it to do, but then we need other mechanisms to understand the risks. If you think that audits are actually evaluating the functionality of critical systems, though, I think then you really need to have good, clear intel around that it's having that function. I've also had this question around, well, it's not an inspection. Audits aren't inspections. They're not supposed to check the functionality. If that's the case, if that's how you structure the use of them, fine. But when we went to the source of these audits, we looked at what they said they were supposed to be achieving. Almost always they said compliance and the functionality, the effectiveness. Almost always they said effectiveness. And that's where we call BS, right? Is that they're possibly not doing that. Maybe they are, but you need to go out there and check.
Cool. Yeah, we got one more. One that's quite interesting to me, a comment, a question about the pressures that people have to push those watermelon metrics up. What would you say about that?
You mean like the completion of audits?
Green on the outside, red on the inside. The company can only really handle good news.
So, yeah, I'm not the biggest supporter of traffic lights and those sort of systems. I think it's so easy to game. In fact, it does have a purpose. It is very symbolic. It's an easy way to convey a message. The problem is it's just so easy to game. You can pretty much sell any message you want using those sort of metrics. I haven't systematically studied the use of traffic lights in audits. I think there's probably more room for harm than there is good. I think what's more useful is understanding whether the audit itself is functioning. So there's this idea around quantitative metrics. Every quantitative metric should be coupled with a qualitative, the narrative, the description of what it actually means. I think it's the same with audits. If you are going to use traffic lights, you have to have some sort of narrative around what it means, what your assumptions are, and what you don't know. And there's a lot of stuff we don't know. So the audit needs to be very clear that it only looked at a desktop analysis of this many people. We didn't observe practices. And sorry, that's something I really didn't cover, what I should have, is that audits are systematically decoupled from work. They don't really assess work all that well. But what they do instead is talk about products of work. They talk about, instead of talking about work at height, they talk about a work at height permit or work at height standard. Instead of talking about vehicle movements, which is critical, the audit is talking about people being killed by vehicles, they talk about vehicle movement plans instead, completely decoupled from work. If that's what your assumption is, that's fine. But I think if you ask the leadership team what you think audits are doing, they're probably going to say, isn't it testing the effectiveness of our not killing people? They're not doing that.
I mean, what a great presentation overall of exactly what he has going on. So, man, what a good time right there. So if you are here in North America, I'm going to tell you here in the next couple of weeks, I will be going up to Energy Safety Canada that they'll be having their event in Banff. Would love to see you there. We're going to do some live broadcasts while we're there. If you want to come by, we'll be hanging out in inside of there where you can take a listen to what we have going on. We'll be doing something similar to as we are doing at the Global Safety Innovation Summit, where we'll be actually broadcasting live and then doing some drops directly afterwards. Love to see you there down at Energy Safety Canada up in Banff. So see you then. Hopefully you enjoyed today's episode. I'll see you next time. I've been your safety manager and host, Jay Allen, here on Safety FM.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.